Welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air.
This is a podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. This podcast is part of a series in which we look at the heritage of the college and at the history of anaesthesia. My name is Anna Maria Rollin. I'm a retired consultant anaesthetist and the current chair of the Heritage and Archives Committee of the college.
I'm delighted to be joined today by Kevin Storey, who was the CEO of the college between 2001 and 2011, and by Dr. Debbie Nolan, who was chair of the Finance Committee and was also vice president of the college.
They will talk about the challenges the college faced and the hurdles which had to be overcome, and most importantly, where the members' money went. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, starting with Kevin, if you would.
Hi, yep, my name's Kevin Storey. I joined the college in 1999 as the finance director, became the chief exec in 2001, and then retired in 2015. Fortunately, I was able to keep being finance director and chief exec during the acquisition of the buildings, and that was very beneficial.
Debbie.
Thank you. My name's Debbie Nolan. I was elected to College Council in 2009, but prior to that, came up through the ranks of college tutor, regional advisor, as it was called in those days, and ultimately examiner, and finished my council career as vice president for 2 years.
So before we discuss the purchase of Churchill House, we must recognise and record the vital work done by previous presidents and councils in buying 4849 Russell Square, subsequently gaining a royal charter that allowed the College of Anaesthetists to become the Royal College of Anaesthetists. We are truly grateful to them and to all the fellows who contributed financially to make that move to Russell Square. The purchase and development of Churchill House really was done standing on the shoulders of others. Thank you all.
One of the things that I'd like to start with is thinking back to funding for substantial buildings for the college. I recall a wave of enthusiasm at that time for fundraising activities. Some examples of that in my own region would be things like cake sales. One of the senior anaesthetists in my region produced a tray of vol-au-vents to be sold at lunchtime, which proved to be inedible because he'd forgotten that actually you need to put the filling in after you've cooked the vol-au-vent cases. But nevertheless, the enthusiasm was there. We had several occasions like dinner dances in my region, which not only raised some money, but also I think because obviously one invited one's surgical colleagues where possible and occasionally colleagues from other specialties, I think it did help to raise the profile of the college externally. And then, of course, there was the Can Locum fundraising, which I think Kevin's going to say more about.
Can Locum Limited was set up to receive donations from fellows to buy the lease on 4849 Russell Square. And donations were made in any way. As you've already said, there have been some fundraising events, but also locum fees and private practice fees went in. And it raised significant amounts of money. It raised in excess of £3.5 million when the lease for 4849 Russell Square was only £2 million, but it did need another £700,000 spending on it to bring it to suitability. So there was a surplus left over, and that went into a fund called the Anaesthetist Academic Fund. The interest on the capital funded research in anaesthesia.
Thank you, Kevin. So can you reflect on the reasons for leaving 4849 Russell Square and eventually buying the current premises at Churchill House?
The answer, in a nutshell, is growth of the specialty. Everyone was happy with 4849 and its limitations. We worked around them until Professor Peter Hutton became president in 2000. He had an absolute vision for inclusivity and for a larger property. I'll expand on the inclusivity first, because, crazy as it sounds, we said goodbye to some anaesthetists if they couldn't get the final exam. We've now got the membership category. We actually had that category before 1999 as well, but nobody was in it. So we were turning away anaesthetists, and that was just fundamentally wrong. And so Peter included everybody, which again helped grow the numbers. He wanted to raise the status of anaesthesia. We had practical problems, but we were generating surpluses, and so we wanted to bring together the sharp end of a specialty. So Intensive Care Society, British Pain Society, and College of Emergency Medicine, as it happened, joined us, and there were shared benefits in that. The Intensive Care Society came to us when we didn't have Churchill House. So we actually took a lease out on a property in Montague Street and popped them in there, becoming their landlord for a couple of years until Churchill House was finished and we could all move in together and then use all the shared educational facilities. Examinations were not able to be held all within the college because of the numbers. And so shepherding examiners and candidates around different venues in London was fraught with some problems. We lost some examiners at lunchtimes who made alternative lunch arrangements. Replacing leasehold properties with freehold properties gave the college greater security over its future. Exiting listed buildings, which were graceful but not fit for purpose as educational properties, they were much more resistant to modernisation. Peter Hutton and I looked at over 100 properties, some on paper, some from outside the property. One Saturday, I brought my bicycle up to London and spent the whole day riding past properties on our list. Those that were not eliminated, we viewed internally. This whole process was hugely valuable as it gave us an insight into the whole London property market, of which we were definitely novices. Peter Hutton's vision initiated the move, but finalising the move was led by Sir Peter Simpson, who succeeded Peter Hutton as president in 2003. It wasn't until 2004 that we bought Churchill House.
Thank you, Kevin. So my first recollection of seeing Churchill House was being given a conducted tour while I was examining down here many years ago now. It's obvious that the building required significant modification from its previous use as a creative space for an advertising agency. It was full of sort of slightly strange things like a ball pit for creative thinking on the top floor to something which would accommodate much better our requirements for educational activities. So, Kevin, is it possible for you to expand on how we achieved that aim?
Of course it is. We were given advice by our advisors. And one of the most important pieces of advice was don't break the slab, which they meant was do not unearth any skeletons. Do not allow archaeologists to occupy the site for 2 years. It's a big risk digging in London. You will find something and it causes delay. So when we wanted to put the lecture theatre in, we did not go down deeper than the existing building. And we still got our 151-seat lecture theatre, which everybody was very happy about. I should really talk about the flow of the building because we wanted to have the lower four floors as the education centre. And that meant that people in exam time especially have got to walk around from station to station and they've got to flow easily. So we removed some of the floor space and replaced it with a large staircase where people could walk side by side and still pass somebody else going in the other direction, and also not to rely on lifts, which caused terrible time delays. So we did do that, and it worked terribly well. There were some little surprises that we found. The original use of the building was as a publisher and a bookstore. So vans used to drive into the building onto a turntable. And during the construction, I was asked, what do you want us to do with the turntable? And I said, is it in our way? We're putting a kitchen on top of it. I said, well, put the kitchen on top of it then, leave it in there. So to this day, there's still a turntable underneath the kitchen if anybody wants to turn their car around instead of having it as a current building. The other thing is that it's called Churchill House because the publishers had a writer called Winston Churchill. And he, well, he didn't lay the first brick because it was made of concrete, but he laid the first piece of concrete. And as you walk out of Churchill House and go down the steps, to the right-hand side, under cover, there is a slab recognising that he laid that on a certain date. But the builders covered it up and it's never been uncovered. So it's there to this day. We moved in to Churchill House in January 2006. We all went home from Russell Square for Christmas and we came back in January to Churchill House. But we had the official opening by Princess Anne on the 16th of January. And that was a lovely time. Very formal, very nice, and nearly the end of the project. In the evening, we had a party. And that party really was one of relief. People who've passed the final examination will know what that is. It was just the end and no more to be done. And so we relaxed, and that was staff and council having horse racing, but with no horses. We had people as the jockeys, and we printed money to bet on with this, a bit like Monopoly money. Only the highest denomination note had the president's face on it, and then the vice president's, and then mine was a fiver, I think. But it was a lovely end to the project.
So can you just remind us, it seems like a much bigger premise centres than Russell Square, obviously. How much larger is Churchill House than the old Russell Square building?
Russell Square was 10,000 square feet and Churchill House is 35,000 square feet, over 10 floors. 4 for education centre and 6 for admin and council chamber, which wasn't here when we bought the building. We popped that on top. I've got a little anecdote here. After we'd bought Churchill House, one evening Peter Simpson was walking back from a meeting with the president of the RCS and they went past Churchill House. Peter was asked how many floors we had. His simple reply was, all of them.
OK, so can we just move on now to the cost and how that was funded?
Of course. The property world always starts with high prices, but then becomes more realistic as they needed cash to buy more property stock. The asking price of Churchill House was £13 million, overpriced and unaffordable. Negotiations between buying and selling agents reduced this, but not to the point of being affordable. Peter Simpson and I decided to cut out the agents and for me to meet the seller directly. Council authorised us to offer up to £10 million. I met the seller directly, explained that we were a serious purchaser, our funding was in place, we were ready to exchange, and we agreed a price of £8.5 million and bought Churchill House. The development cost to make the building suitable for our purpose was £7.5 million. The money came from a variety of sources. College investments. We banked our investments when they were sufficient to buy a freehold property with an affordable mortgage. A prudent decision, as the equity markets then fell and didn't recover for a decade. An interest-free loan of £1 million from the BJA in return for space to hold their archive of journals. We were making annual surpluses of £1 million, so we're good for a mortgage until we sold Russell Square. Remember Can Locum and the AAF, the Anaesthetists Academic Foundation? It was agreed with its trustees that we could use the capital for Churchill House, as that was in line with the original request to fellows that it be used for college property. The college continued the academic research funding from its annual surpluses and joint BJA funding.
Holding some reserves is prudent, but then spending the surplus on the specialty is the way forward. Generating annual surpluses is the key to all of this good work.
Peter Simpson hand-signed about 10,000 letters to fellows asking for further donations, which were successful. We tried raising funds outside the college, and the Wolfson Foundation was generous with £400,000. The Cloth Workers Company donated £50,000. We got very little else from external. We did have a fundraising dinner with our Princess Royal, which was a very enjoyable evening, but raised little funds. All of the above gave us our £16 million and allowed Churchill House to be bought, developed and to become our home. We came in about £50,000 under budget, but 2 weeks late. I never shared our budget with our builders or advisors. I did share our calendar, my mistake. Within 2 years of moving in, the BJA loan was repaid with interest. Russell Square was sold, the mortgage was paid off, and college investments were replaced from the annual surpluses generated. We could have bought outside London much bigger, better properties for less money, but it wasn't the right location. We did a postcode analysis of all fellows, members and trainees, and it was really split into thirds. One third was near London. One third were a long way from London, but with good connectivity to London. For example, Edinburgh, Cardiff, Belfast. The other third being scattered around the country. London was good for medical-political relationships. Anaesthesia was moving up the medical status ladder, and having a London-based president meant good informal relationships with other colleges and the Department of Health. This was also good for me as chief exec, as we were being seen as a well-governed and managed organisation, and I was asked to sit on other colleges, audit committees, interview panels, etc.
Thanks for that insight, Kevin. One of the things I'd like to comment on, really, is that the college felt so different to the National Health Service that most of us worked in. One of those things was obviously resource management. The NHS always felt very cash-strapped, whereas the college always seemed to have a philosophy to either spend or certainly to reinvest in the specialty. And that was a refreshing change, I think, for the wider anaesthetic community.
Thank you. My role was to secure the income. Anaesthetists knew what it should be spent on. Debbie, can you please say what the anaesthetic community thought of the increase in status of the college?
Yes, I think there are several aspects to this, really. And I think after we became independent from the College of Surgeons, there was a sense amongst the anaesthetic community, maybe not revolution, but certainly an evolution of the specialty, a confidence that our specialty was moving forwards in all sorts of ways. I think for me personally, and for other people who were doing similar jobs like regional advisor or examiner, Square. I think the building was very important. Russell Square was a very prestigious building, beautiful place, but actually not fit for the sort of purpose that we were developing. Meetings were often cramped, overheated. For the examiners, the call over at the end of the day was done in a very small room that really, the acoustics were terrible. It was just a very uncomfortable environment. And I think the move to Churchill House made a big difference to that. The examiners were happier and perhaps were more enthusiastic, which is always a good thing in an examiner. I think the other comment that I would like to make is the staff, really. They're at the heart of any organisation. I got to know many of the staff very well over the years, and they were always enthusiastic. One day when it was particularly overheated at the college, one afternoon, the chief executive, Mr. Story, went out and bought the staff ice creams. A small gesture, but meant an awful lot to the people on the ground. I was privileged enough to sit on one or two appointments committees over the years, and certainly the sort of candidates that we were interviewing were highly qualified and were very competitive in their field.
Thank you, Debbie. Yep, we expected the best. So we were very, very certain when to appoint somebody and when not to.
One of the other questions that people bandy about, and I think I probably know the answer to this, but is it true that Churchill House has a wine cellar?
Absolutely not. No. We bought wine for dinners from Odbins. There was a cupboard in the lower ground floor that held sufficient for about two dinners. Whenever I gave fellows a tour of the building, I always opened this cupboard to show them. Other medical royal colleges suffered the displeasure of the Charity Commission over excessive wine collections. We never did.
So, Kevin, can you expand a little bit for us in terms of what the other medical royal colleges did, particularly in terms of freehold purchase?
Well, before we bought the freehold of Churchill House, nearly all medical royal colleges were leasehold. From memory, only the RCS owned their freehold. After we bought Churchill House, other colleges followed suit, namely the obstetricians and gynaecologists, pathologists, ophthalmologists, paediatric and child health, GPs and psychiatrists. Have all secured their longer-term futures with freehold.
Can I ask why that makes a difference?
Well, if you want to do some changes to your building and you're not the freeholder, you have to get permission from the freeholder, even if you've got a 999-year lease. So that can be restrictive. And buying freeholds, you generally are not buying listed properties. The leaseholds that the Medical Royal Colleges were in were all quite grand buildings, and they were listed. And it's both of those items that make it better for freehold. I'm now going to say about the building next door. Churchill House was number 35, or it still is, number 35, Red Lion Square. Adjoining it was 34 Red Lion Square, a property over eight floors. Its ground and lower ground floors were office space, but the upper six floors had a two-bedroom flat on each floor. In 2007, it came on the market, freehold, and we were interested in buying. We had rebuilt our investments a little. We continued to make annual surpluses of £1 million. We could sell the long lease we had on the flat on Russell Square, but we would need a mortgage to tide us over until the flat was sold. Judith Hulf was president. Council decided to purchase it. A price was agreed with the vendor. The UK had seen the first run on a bank for very many years. Northern Rock was bailed out of trouble by the government. Banks were nervous about lending. They'd been criticised for lending too easily. No mortgage offer was forthcoming. Our credit rating was high. All paperwork had been completed, but no one at the bank would authorise our mortgage. We didn't want to lose the property, so we decided to rattle the cage. I sent a short email to the chairman of our bank. I told him that if we were having trouble, what was his bank doing to help other organisations in the UK during this time of financial upset? I copied that letter to the Chancellor of the Exchequer and to the Governor of the Bank of England, Alastair Darling and Mervyn King. Within an hour, I received a call from the bank's chairman's PA. Within 24 hours, the funding requested had been transferred to our account. We exchanged contracts and bought the freehold of 34 Red Lion Square. We used the top two flats for college use. We sold the long lease on the flat on Russell Square. We paid off the mortgage. We rented out the office space. We rented out the other four flats. The rents received were considerable. College investments rose. I'd like to finish, if I may, on answering the title of the podcast. And the answer is, the external funding was £500,000, so the remaining £15.5 million, 97%, was raised from fellows, directly in donations and indirectly in in the legacy of Canlocum. Annual surpluses, even the repayment of the BJA loan, was funded by fellows money. So the answer is that the fellows money went into the purchase and development of Churchill House. Their money has allowed Churchill House to provide educational facilities for all fellows, members and trainees since the purchase. And that is where the fellows money remains today, albeit increased in monetary terms by the rise in the London property market.
Thank you both for an enlightening podcast. Many things I didn't know, many things I should have known and didn't know. And I'm grateful to both of you for your time and for telling us the story of this extraordinary building, which has done us proud.